This is a HeadGum Original.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Should we just start talking? Is that how this works? Or
I think it's your show.
Yeah.
Make sure they're recording.
When I was 17 years old, I was in a production of Ordinary People in Columbia, Missouri. One of the actors that I worked with was a senior in college there, John Hamm. Hi, John.
Hi.
How old were you when we did that play?
In 92, I would have been 21.
21. You seemed so much older to me at the time.
Yes, when you were 19 years old?
I was 17 years
17.
Old. 17. And like our scenes were all just like looking into each other's souls, kind of. We were making a lot of eye contact.
Well, there were two-handers, basically. It was a one-on-one kind of scene.
Do you have any memory of whether my eyes ever looked dead?
I will say this. You were playing a heavily medicated, depressed teen. So if they did, that was on character. It was a choice. You made a great choice. I don't know what to tell you. You made a great choice.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
I'm Connor Ratliff. I'm an actor and comedian. 20 years ago, I was fired by Tom Hanks. I was told the reason was that he saw my audition tape and he thought that I had dead eyes. And that's the short version. Actors audition and we either get the job or we don't, but we almost never know if we came close or if we completely missed the mark. People who are casting actors often don't know what they're looking for until they see it. It's kind of a big jumbled mess, and it sort of has to be, because in a lot of cases, it's more art than science. I started doing plays when I was about 10 years old. I was in a local community theater production of Oliver, where I played one of the orphans, but I couldn't dance well enough to be one of Fagin's pickpockets, which was fine with me because it actually freed me up to have a line of dialogue in a later scene in the play. I played a kid who delivered some books, and my line of dialogue was, "Here's the books you ordered from the bookseller, sir." I said it in a very poor British accent. I would later work in a bookstore for 13 years, if you're trying to, like, make connections. My dad tried to be an actor back in Chicago in the early 1970s, but by the time I was born, he was working as the local weatherman on KRCG TV 13 in Jefferson City, Missouri. And in addition to doing the weather on the 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock news, he hosted a live TV kids show called Showtime.
It's time for Showtime, the fun time that's just for kids.
This was on Monday through Friday at 3:30 in the afternoon, and kids would watch it when they got home from school. It was my dad, and there was a guy doing puppets, and the studio audience was made up of groups of local school kids. There would also be guests. There was the library lady who would bring in books that were new at the local library for kids.
Halloween will be coming soon, so I've got a couple of Halloween books. The first one is called The Witch's Hat, and it's the story of a witch who is stirring up a brew, and her hat falls in the pot. And now this is a magic pot, naturally, since it belongs to a witch.
But at a certain point, a big corporation bought KRCG TV 13, and they decided to cancel my dad's show and replace it with Dallas reruns. Anyway, on the last episode of my dad's TV show, that stage production of Oliver that I was in came on the show to promote the play. It was my dad, two of the main cast members performing a scene and a song, and me. Now, because it was my dad's show, I was given the opportunity to introduce the musical number in character, although it wasn't really like a character from the show. This was just an intro that somebody wrote, and I'm playing a generic British orphan introducing Oliver Twist and the Artful Dodger for the musical number Consider Yourself.
Hello, I'm an orphan. Over here are a couple of me mates. The chap in the high hat is called the Artful Dodger. He's a clever one, he is. The other chap is called Oliver. He's new around here. We're trying to make him fit at home. Watch!
In my defense, I was 10 years old, and the British dialect I was doing, I was basing it on what the older kids in the cast were doing.
What are you staring at? Ain't you ever seen a gent?
No, I haven't.
It's not a very good accent, but it's what I was hearing.
Oh, well, I say, you must be running from the bake.
The what?
Now, don't tell me you don't know what a bake is, me flash mate.
So after the musical number, there was this brief interview, and I got to be there, even though I was just the kid who had done the intro.
To the audience, but I think we'll do okay.
You've been in shows before, right?
Yes, I was in a musical at Simonson called Piers of Driven Snow.
And my dad asks me a leading question. Notice this, he doesn't ask me if this is my first play.
And this is your first time, right?
Yes, this is my first.
He tells me it is my first play, and then says, right? And if you watch the clip, you can see it dawn on me that I have been tricked into saying this is my first play. And I realize I had one previous credit as an actor.
Come to think of it, it isn't my first show.
I did
a thing for Missouri Players at Tenanzio's. I played a clown in The Unwicked Witch.
Okay, I know, you did fine.
It's a pretty disastrous first interview. I was visibly unhappy with being disrespected on live television by my dad. Even then, my acting career was a nightmare.
We think nine.
Or later.
It might be later. Okay, hey, you know, I guess it wouldn't be showtime without a cartoon. Would you like to see a cartoon?
Uh-huh.
Now,
after that, I started doing plays every chance I got. I did Fiddler on the Roof, The King and I, Brighton Beach Memoirs. I also was in a couple of local TV commercials for a car dealership.
The wine sale continues with 7.9% APR financing on selected models, no matter what color.
I was constantly doing plays. I did school plays, community theater, plays I put on with my friends. But my first professional theater gig happened the summer before my senior year of high school.
I just remember you being so good in it and not
really
knowing anything. Really?
This is Emmy Award-winning actor John Hamm.
And not knowing anything about you, like, who is this kid? Kind of just having such a good time doing the play, because the majority of the play is you and me talking.
Yeah.
It's like a therapy session, basically.
It's very intense, one-on-one. Like, those were my favorite scenes in the play, because it's just two actors really going at it. You were pushing me to my limits, like both the character and like the actor. It's one of those things where we're kind of, it felt like sparring matches, kind of.
Well, it's the theatrical version of therapy. Like, anybody that's actually been to therapy knows it's not like, tell me the truth.
Yeah.
But, you know, therapy in real life is more like, how was your week? Like, you know, like, it was okay. Like, I guess, you know, kind of bummed out about work or whatever, you know. It's not the fireworks that everybody kind of makes it out to be, but that's the wonder of drama.
I'm fascinated to hear you say that you thought that I was good, because
I'm pretty sure I told you that at the time.
Well, you were very nice to me. I wasn't sure because I was a high schooler, and particularly coming into the summer rep that summer, I had sort of taken a part that could have gone to any number of drama majors who were at the college.
Well, so my story was, I was a transfer to Mizzou.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I transferred in my junior year. So I was kind of in your shoes of like, am I taking somebody else's part? Like, I'm the new guy and everybody. And it was definitely that, you know, the theater is also very clicky and very, you know, can be very mean girly and you can't sit with us kind of a thing. But I ingratiated myself fairly quickly, and as I imagine you did.
Well, all summer long, I wasn't sure whether anybody liked me or whether people were just being nice. I remember being really nervous. Whenever they said, we're going to do the play, we've done the play all summer long with this cast, and we're going to do it again for two more weeks in September, and everyone can do it except the actor playing the therapist. And I remember finding out that it was going to be a student who was going to be doing it. And my initial reaction, I remember, was like, what? No. Like, I was like,
I'm back to playing with kids again.
How quickly I had gone from being this lucky high school student who scored this great part to being like,
wanting casting approval.
Yeah, wait, what? He's only, you know, in his 20s. He can't be a therapist. It won't make sense. And then immediately, as soon as we started doing rehearsals together, I was like, oh, no, this is great. This is going to be...
Well, I remember I had to, like, grow out a beard, which was a drag because it was, you know, for those of you who have never experienced a Midwestern summer, it was just so hot and sticky and gross. And I had this big beard and I was like, all right, anything to make me look marginally older. And so I ended up looking like a, you know, like a shitty little scrappy, like, grad student, which is probably a pretty good fit for Tyrone.
I think it ended up, for Tyrone C. Berger.
Tyrone C. Berger, the therapist. I didn't even realize, like, hamburger? That's amazing.
I think it ended up looking like you were like, oh, this guy's so good that he's like a prodigy. You were like the Doogie Howser of therapy, and you've been doing this a while.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
Now, skipping forward ahead into later in our lives, past that. Have you ever been fired from an acting job?
Yes, I have. The circumstances were kind of weird. It was sort of out of their hands in some way. It wasn't like, oh, you're terrible, we can't use you. Bye. I've never had the experience which I know several people have, where they've gone to like the table read, and after the table read, like their phone rings and they're like, yeah, don't bother coming on Monday. Where you're like, oh, how bad was I? And the answer is bad enough to...
Yeah, it answers itself. It's a question that the firing is the answer.
So I had so many of those. I still tell Jon Favreau to this day, like, I lost a part to you. Like, it was for Deep Impact, which was a movie, you know, back in the whatever. It was the other asteroid going to hit the Earth that wasn't Armageddon.
Yeah, it was the one that was, like, really emotionally, like, nuanced and compelling. It was the Mimi Leder
directed it, and Steven Spielberg executive produced it, and, like, I was, like, my mind was blown that I was in this room, and they really, really wanted me, and Jon Favreau was just coming off of Swingers.
Yeah.
And was, like, the hottest thing in Hollywood. And they were like, no, let's get that guy. He's a hot commodity.
For me, when I was cast in Band of Brothers, it was one of those very small role, and it was one of those things where, you know, you're going to audition after audition, and they're keeping more people in the room and fewer people going in from the waiting area, and I was supposed to film my scenes on a Tuesday, and I was getting a train from Liverpool down to London on a Monday. And I got a phone call from my agent saying, you need to get on a train right now because Tom Hanks has seen your audition tape and he's having second thoughts. He thinks you have dead eyes. And so I had to get on
a train. Nicest man in Hollywood.
I had to get on a train. And the lines, my character's lines were all things like, yes, sir, no, sir. Would you like any coffee, sir? There were no passionate speeches about, like,
right,
you know, this war.
You know, you weren't standing in front of a three-story flag.
There was not and so I remember that train ride riding down to London thinking, how do I make my eyes pop while also playing this very, like, utilitarian, like, this very functional minor character? You do not want to draw attention to yourself in that kind of
part. It's not like you want to, like, draw focus.
Yeah, you don't want to do like a Mr. Bean style eye popping.
Shtick.
Yeah,
right.
And so the whole time I'm thinking, what do I do? What do I do? And I went in and I had to personally re audition for Tom Hanks, and then they took me out of the room and
shot you in the head. There is no feeling like that thing of like, and I've certainly had it where I thought I got the part in the room, or I thought I got, you know, the break that was going to break me, you know, for the end of time. Because I when I first came to L.A., I auditioned for everything.
When you've been on the other side of the casting table, like, is dead eyes a term that you've ever heard?
No, absolutely not. It's a strange alchemy. Like, when it works and you see it. And sometimes I've had this experience too, which I feel like has happened to me on many occasions. But I remember we were casting a part on Mad Men, and this guy came in and he killed it. He was so good. And we were like, oh my God, like, that guy is such a good actor and did such a good job of the part. He couldn't have looked more wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the guy was supposed to be like scrappy Lower East Side Jew. And this guy walks in and looks like, you know, C. Thomas Howell. And you're just like, oh, like, no, like there's nothing we can do to you to make you look this part. Like you did everything right, except the costume doesn't fit. You know what I mean? Like, it's just that kind of thing.
So that guy didn't get the part.
He did not get the part. And it was a bummer.
Because he just wasn't, he wasn't right for it.
He literally wasn't right for it. It was one of those things like, we're going another way. Like, we're going the way that the script intended. You were great. It's a tightrope act. You know, you're kind of like, you're in certain ways, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. My very first film that I ever did was a movie called We Were Soldiers. And it was a, you know, kind of a Vietnam era war story, basically. It was about the first entanglement between regular North Vietnamese forces and United States forces. The first battle. And it's this battle that's written about and studied in, you know, war college and whatnot. But my part, which my agents were like, you should not take this part. There's nothing there. Don't, it's useless. But my part was like, I was like, but I'm next to Mel Gibson in almost all the scenes. Like I'm the guy who's like, sir, this just came for you, sir. We have to do this. But also, sir, like, you know, like all my scenes are talking to him. Those aren't going to get cut out. I might, but the words won't. And they might, and let me try to be good enough that they'll stay in.
Yeah. That was my, because my part in this was supposed to be me and Damian Lewis. All my scenes would be me with Damian Lewis. And so
there
I thought, I'm not saying a lot, but it's who I'm with. That all I have to do is like listen and be there. And
exactly. And so it was my first film. So anyway, when the movie came out, and I remember going to see a screening, and I was kind of like, well, I'm in the movie. I guess I got invited to a screening. So I must be in it somewhere. And, I watched it and I was like, oh shit, like I'm actually kind of in it more than a little. And I came out and the editor came up to me. He goes, hey, I want to introduce myself. I forget his name, but the editor of the film. I said, oh, cool. Thanks for putting me in. He goes, you were the only one that was paying attention.
Wow.
I said, what do you mean? He goes, whenever we needed like a cutaway to somebody, everyone else was kind of like, fucking around or like not engaged, like you were the only one that was paying attention. And I was like, well, that's a good note. Like, pay attention.
Dead Eyes will be back in just a moment. You should listen to this now, though. Don't fast forward. Your thumbs are too big. The interface on the thing you listen to podcasts to is too imprecise. You think you're going to save time by skipping ahead. You won't. You're going to skip back. You're going to overshoot it in both directions. Just calm down and listen to this.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
See, if you tried to shoot ahead, it didn't work. Now let's get back to the show. I talked to my friend Nicole Dressbell. You've probably seen her on shows like Broad City or 30 Rock. And we worked together when she was a writer on the Chris Gethard show. She's great. I've told you the story, right?
Yes. Well, I think I knew it as a story about, I don't even know if you've ever told me, but I think I knew it as a story about you.
You just heard it.
Yes.
Like the story had made the rounds.
The story made the rounds.
What did you hear?
That Connor almost got a Tom Hanks movie and then Tom Hanks personally nixed him for Dead Eyes.
Okay. Yeah.
Great.
That's it. Okay. I brought something.
Oh no.
In this envelope.
I think I know what okay.
What do you think is in the envelope?
I think, are you going to make me do the sides with you?
Yes.
Okay, I don't want to.
That's okay. You don't have to, I just thought.
But I'm going to do it like a casting associate. Does that make sense? I don't want anybody to be assessing my acting ability.
I found these. It truly isn't a case that I'm so obsessed that I've kept everything. It really, truly was an accident that when I started working on this podcast, I have this filing cabinet and I put things in it, but I never clean it out. I never sort it. I never organize it. And at some point, I have an envelope that has the script for episode 5, the full script.
Wait, I gasped, but it's like, yeah. That's out there. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Can I read this? So these were faxed to you on June 12th, 2000. I guess originally I was not impressed that you had the sides but this is before email.
No, it's not before email.
I thought we got email right after 9/11.
No. Oh, Nicole.
I don't know. I'm so young.
Email happened. I graduated high school in 93, and I feel like email became a thing shortly after that.
Okay, well, I didn't have it. At least for me. But I was also so young.
Right. So what I'm curious about, I have the scene here, and I think this is the same as what you have. And I'm curious to just do a cold read. I haven't looked at these in years, so these lines will be fresh to me, too.
Also, I do think people at home should know, this is like... First of all, I think they typed this on a typewriter. And this is a fax copy of a typewriter. It's hard to read, is what I'm saying.
Tom Hanks famously loves typewriters.
Yes, he does. He made an app.
Typewriter app.
Which I guess of all the celebrity vanity projects.
I like it.
Yeah.
I don't know if they advertise with podcasts, but that'd be a great sponsor to get for this.
Oh, that'd be really interesting.
Yeah. I'm just realizing now. I've forgotten that the stage direction for this scene says... A slightly overweight private first class Zelensky pours coffee into a porcelain cup for Winters. And it's just another one of those examples of where they could have written this without saying that he's slightly overweight. It doesn't factor into the plot. There's not a point where they pack him into a suitcase and they have to pay extra money because it goes slightly over.
It's the sort of thing they could tell casting and make sure never gets written down. It's wild to me the things that they will send to actors in a script.
It's also such a small slight that it would be so easy to cut it.
Yes.
There's plenty of characters in countless movies and TV shows who are slightly overweight and it's never addressed. It's just true.
When I did 30 Rock, all the reviews felt the need to mention my weight. And the ones that said slightly were my favorite. So I will say, I think they thought they were doing a favor by adding the slightly.
Yeah, that's a thin person's compliment.
Yes, it is.
How about this? I'll read the scene directions just for the listener.
Okay.
And then you read everything except Zelensky.
I don't think that's right either.
The listener of the podcast needs the scene directions.
I don't think that they do.
Okay, let's just try. So no scene directions.
In this first take.
Great. All right. And I might do them badly. This could actually be
just a quick note about what you're about to hear. This is the full scene that we read in the re-audition. Nicole will be reading multiple roles, and I only say a few lines in it. Most of the time, I was just sitting there listening and reacting while the other person does all the talking. If that sounds at all awkward, that is because it was.
The heart of.
So I'll just start out. So basically, Tom Hanks says, "All right, let's hear it."
You didn't read with him, did you?
No, he's sitting there though. But I remember he said something along the lines of, "All right, let's hear it. I noticed your light on, sir, and thought you might need some Joe. Anything else I could get for you?"
"No. It's one up for Anglo-American relations. How you doing? Who are you?"
"Private First Class Zelensky, sir."
"My battalion orderly." "Nice. Rank has its privileges."
"Coffee, sir?"
"Any news on Pegasus?" "Oh, God. Noses?" "Connor. Noses brought in all..."
That's moose.
"Connor, I can't... I feel like this..."
Here, you take this one, because I feel like I would have fired you if you were the actor for saying noses instead of moose.
Okay, well...
This is really hard to read. What I gave you is really hard to read.
Do you see?
Oh, yeah. It does look...
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so... "Coffee, sir?"
"Any news on Pegasus?" "Moose brought in all 140 and not a shot was fired. Strayer's pretty well full of himself. You really ought to come down." "Well, if it's all squared away, I'm going to hit the sack." "You can give this to Strayer." "2 pages. All that in 2 pages? Did you break a sweat?" "Can I trust Zelensky here?" "Zelensky, that'll be all." "We're moving. Word is down the river opposite Arnhem. We'll be occupying the easternmost tip of the entire Allied advance, farther into Nazi territory than any other outfit in ETO. At least the men on the line will be. While you'll be back in some cozy HQ with your typewriter and your battalion orderlies."
"I'll wrangle that, sir. Once these ribbons come undone, it's one big mess. I'll have this back in order in a jiffy, sir. And that's the scene. That's it.
That's it?
When we finished reading the scene, Tom Hanks said, "Oh, is that it? Oh, I wish there were more."
Oh, no.
Big laugh, big fun. It was like a fun moment.
Oh, no.
And I felt like that was a good sign. Like, yes. Oh, we're having fun.
Right.
Like, yeah, it's not that big a part. You don't need to recast me.
Right.
It's barely in it.
Yeah, right. Oh, I came out here. I reassured you. Everybody feels good. Let's go. Wow.
How did my eyes look when I was looking up that time?
Intense.
Really?
Yeah.
Too intense, maybe.
Yeah, but I mean, you felt like you were on the spot about your eyes.
I'm sure they were too intense when I did the re-audition.
Yeah, the only thing I'll say is it feels old to play an orderly. I don't know that I would cast you as an orderly.
I was in my early 20s then.
Right.
You're saying now.
Yeah, I can only make an assessment based on now.
What do you think of that as an audition scene?
It's nothing. But I also, I mean, this really drums home just how unreasonable the entire thing is. Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
Like, is this a fun anecdote that you're milking, or is there really something under here that you're looking to examine?
There used to be something that was painful about this.
Right.
Now it's something that's interesting to me.
When do you think it stopped being painful?
Probably in my 30s. This happened in my 20s. And in my 20s, I went through a brief period of success followed by just years of failure. And then in my 30s, like I would say the first half of my 30s was me becoming comfortable with, I sort of redefined what success was in my mind.
Which was not having goals?
Well, no, it was that I had to figure out a way where my like feeling good wasn't so heavily dependent on whether or not other people liked me or liked what I did.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, like, show business is kind of too nasty and fickle a business to put your feelings into. And so the downside of it is I don't know that I'll ever be as excited to book any show business job or have any. I don't know that there's any show business success I could have that would make me as happy as I was when I got this part on Band of Brothers. I think I've lowered my threshold for how much joy I can feel.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I like, when something good happens and I like it, I can only feel so happy about it. But I can also, I kind of like, to put this in like sound wave terms, it's like that clipping where the high highs are gone, but the low lows are also gone. So it's, my show business emotional range is right in the middle. So if I audition for something and I want it and I don't get it, there's always an upside now in my mind. There's always, I was up for a really cool TV show recently that is filled with people that it's going to be a big deal and it's filled with people that I like and that I would love to work with. And I thought I did a really, really good audition for it. And it was for like a series regular, which I haven't had a lot of those auditions. And I did the audition. I thought like, that's good. Like, and I rarely think that about an audition, but I also thought, this would really screw up my October.
Connor.
And when I realized that I hadn't booked it, I actually felt kind of good because it was like, great, I don't need to change anything in my calendar.
Okay, see, this is where you and I overlap very much. Would you say my ideal situation is for somebody to tell me all of my dreams are gonna come true in like a month or in like 2 months? Like, I don't want anything right now and right. I don't want anything never. But I want it at like a time in the future that feels like it might not even happen anyway.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I haven't thought about it in those terms. But it's very hard to transfer some of these things because they're personal coping mechanisms. What do you think I could have done, Nicole?
Oh, I don't think you could have done anything. I don't think, I mean, not to undermine this whole podcast, but I think like little pieces, little parts like this really are just random feelings and vibes.
Random feelings and vibes. As an actor going out on auditions, booking some jobs, not booking most jobs, it does feel almost random. You'll recall in the previous episode, I tried for several months to get in touch with Band of Brothers casting director Suzanne Smith and finally got a hold of her agent, who very politely made it clear that this podcast wasn't something she was interested in being a part of, which is fine and totally understandable. But I figured, you know, if she won't talk to me, I'll talk to another casting director. I'll get their take on it, because I needed to talk to someone who understands what this whole process is like from the other side of things, so it's not just me and my assumptions, right? And that's when I realized that no casting directors wanted to talk to me about this. I asked one who immediately said they were not comfortable with it. So I asked another who basically said the exact same thing. This happened several times. I had mistakenly thought that because a handful of famous actors have been willing to talk to me, that it would just open the floodgates and I would be able to get other kinds of people to appear on this podcast. But actors love to go on podcasts and talk because actors, and I include myself in this, are not normal people. Was this podcast a bad idea? I started to worry that I was burning bridges with casting directors by even asking them to be a part of it. I even considered seeing if I could get somebody to talk to me using one of those
voice-altering effects people use when they give an interview and they want to be completely anonymous.
Fortunately, I didn't have to resort to witness protection-style devices. I got a New York City casting director to talk to me. If you had to guess, why do you think they re-auditioned me?
Tom saw your audition. He was like, this isn't what I had in my head. And the casting director probably said, you should really meet him in person. We really liked him. Everyone else really liked him. Meet him in person. Give him a chance. And then if you hate him, then we can still kind of look to recast.
So you think he hated him?
Oh, God damn it, Connor.
That's your professional opinion. His name is Seth White, and I've been auditioning for him since 2013. He actually was the first casting director to cast me for a TV show after I returned to professional acting. Seth has cast me in a few other things, but more often than not, I do not get the job. And Seth likes me. I'm just not always right for every job, and this is a really competitive business.
I hope you won't take this personally, that you weren't my first choice.
That's understandable.
Since you didn't cast Band of Brothers, I did try to talk to the casting director who cast me and then had to break the news to me. I was told that she didn't want to be a part of this.
Have you ever heard the term dead eyes professionally? Someone has dead eyes?
I've never heard someone say that to me, like speaking of an actor.
Right.
It's never really come up.
What about like no light behind the eyes?
That like there's like, it's normally like there's something like I'm not feeling anything from this person. Right.
There's nobody home.
There's, yes, exactly.
Right. Did anything about the story surprise you?
Being in casting for kind of as long as I am, not really. Like it's an interesting story just kind of because of the timing of things for you, like not even making it to set. But it's, you know, kind of par for the course kind of in our business sometimes.
And how often do you have to break the news?
It's, you know, we have to break it to the agent.
Who to the reps.
Then has to break it to the client.
Have you ever had to look an actor in the eye and tell them that that they're going another way?
Not like after like an audition, you can look an actor in the eye and say, have a good day.
Yeah, normally like when I have come in to audition for something, you'll always say the same thing, which is like, oh, thanks, good to see you. You know, you always say like nice things, whether it goes my way or not.
Yeah.
What's the hardest part about sitting through that many auditions?
Just like it's an endurance trial sometimes. And, you know, you're reading the same things over and over and over again and seeing the same things. And you're ultimately giving the same direction over and over again. It's just trying to kind of break through the monotony of the day to like find like what you need for a certain part or, you know, out of a certain actor.
It's interesting to me because I would have assumed that part of being a casting director is that you have like a photographic memory that you hold on to every audition in your mind.
Like, you know, we're seeing, you know, anywhere between 50 and 100 people a day sometimes. Like if I couldn't possibly keep all that in my head, and it would probably drive me insane at some point if I tried to. Some people can. But yeah, you remember the good and you remember the very bad. Mm-hmm. And then everything else is kind of just a wash. I'm sure she remembers that.
I don't know if she would.
I think she would because, like, I remember everyone we've had to, like, recast in my career so far. And yours is such, like, an involved story.
Yeah, there's a major movie star.
You spend a day
in the heart of this story.
I'm sure it's something she remembers, and I'm sure when it came across her desk, she was like, I just kind of don't want to deal with this.
Yeah. I was surprised by how much it hurt my feelings when she didn't want to talk to me, because it felt like I sort of wanted her to know that I turned out okay. You know, like all indications of this podcast put to the side.
Yeah.
And I thought like, oh, she'll think this is like, oh, great. Like you went through this, but then you took some time off and then you came back and now you're, you know, working in various TV shows and you're doing okay. And I kind of thought it would be a nice healing experience. That's like, I wanted to tell her how nice she was to me that day.
It's so hard because, like, with actors, like, it's – the casting process is so far out of your hands. You know, you could give the best performance. You could, you know, just be everything that they want. And then there's just one small little thing that, you know, so he could have – Tom Hanks just could have been having a bad day, honestly. And he saw your audition and was just like, it's not this. Not today. I'm going to bring some power into my life and just get rid of this one thing.
Things like that can fuck you up. Acting and especially professional acting and trying to navigate a career in this business is so much about confidence and momentum. And when one or both of those is disrupted, you're kind of like, am I doing anything right? I'm 48 years old. Like, I've been doing this more than I haven't in my life at this point. But when you're younger and something like this happens, I had it happen to me 15 times with pilots, to the point where Les Moonves at CBS had told my agents to stop sending me in because, and I quote, John Hamm will never be a television star.
Wow. What did you feel like when you heard that?
Not great. And then you start to, what did I do in the room? Like, I didn't like just shit my pants. Like I know I wasn't terrible. What is it? And it's just, who knows? Like it's maybe I remind that guy of another guy that he just didn't like, or, you know, you just never know and you'll never get a straight answer.
Does stuff like that stick with you? Like that sentence from Les Moonves, I think that's such that it feels like aggressive to the point where it could be haunting.
Well, or just weirdly personal in a business where it's not supposed to be personal. There are so many conflicting theories on like what to do when you go into an audition room. And the only one that makes any sense is try not to feel like a total piece of shit, because it always feels like shit when you walk into an audition room. Everybody's distracted. It's you don't want to do too much and you don't want to do too little and you don't want to be Mr. Bean and you don't want to have dead eyes and you just want it to be over. Both sides, honestly, because I've been on both sides of that table. All the people on the casting side of the table want is for someone to come in and knock it out of the park. And then all you want to do is try to make some kind of connection and some kind of impact. It's such a conflicting, difficult thing.
Have you ever crossed paths with Tom Hanks, either personally or professionally?
I 100% have. I have his email.
Oh, really?
Yes,
are you pals? Are you friendly? Or are you professionally friendly?
Yeah, I think we're friendly.
Eventually, I don't know where this process of, you know, investigating this and exploring this would go, but if I get to the point where I get the courage and the opportunity to talk to Tom about my eyes... would you be willing to come along with me if that ever happened, or if that?
Of course,
yeah.
Of course, the facilitator.
Yeah. Can I just ask? Do you think you could describe my eyes?
Uh oh.
All right.
There you go.
I'm gonna get as close in now. Hold on.
See, I think you have quite lively eyes, and they're very clear. Are they blue?
I think they're green gray.
Green.
Yeah.
Green gray. Yeah. I would say that there's a lot of emotion coming through. You want it specific?
Yeah, anything that pops into your head.
The French have a word, tristesse.
Tristesse, what does that mean?
Sadness.
Sad eyes. See, that's wonderful. That's a Bruce Springsteen song.
In the next episode of Dead Eyes, I'll talk to my friend Adam Conover, creator and star of Adam Ruins Everything.
As a person who has his own TV show, he knows just how many big and small decisions need to be made every day, including hiring people and firing people.
Not a single person involved in this story thought about it again for the rest of their lives.
I'll also talk to another Adam Sims, someone I've wanted to talk to for almost two full decades.
This was weird because there's two other actors in this vehicle. We all know that we're going for the same part, but at that point, I have no idea whether or not we were told that we would meet Tom Hanks for the audition.
Because Adam Sims is the actor who replaced me on Band of Brothers. Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It's written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. The show is produced and edited by Harry Nelson and Mike Comite. Special thanks to my guests, John Hamm, Nicole Drespel, and Seth Weiss. If you like Dead Eyes, please let us know by doing all the things that podcasts ask you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast, and most importantly, tell your friends about this show, especially if you're friends with Tom Hanks. By the way, I really want him to win a third Oscar for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. He's played so many iconic American characters like Walt Disney or Sully, and now Mr. Rogers. It's just perfect, and he's long overdue to win that third trophy. Anything we can do to help, we're happy to do it. See you next week, neighbor.
That was a HeadGum Original.